evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 5th, 2018. Amnesty International accuses the South Sudan government of arresting scores of people and torturing them while in detention.
Many people have been arrested simply because they belong to the Nuer community of the armed opposition leader, Riek Machar. Many people have been picked up for some time, especially during the heat of the violence, and they've been held for so long and accused of communicating with the rebels.
And President Salva Kiir's spokesman dismisses the Amnesty International's report, calling it cut and paste.
All the allegations that came in the report were not new because they have been said before. Each time the government of South Sudan gets closer to returning the country to normalcy, such reports are just cut and faced and released.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A new report says South Sudan security forces continue to arrest, detain and torture people despite repeated promises from President Salva Kiir to release detainees. Seif Magongo is Amnesty International's Deputy Director for East Africa. He tells VOA's James Batty that a number of former detainees have described horrific conditions and treatment at secret detention centers in South Sudan.
People continue to be detained arbitrarily long periods of time in South Sudan. And not only are they detained, they are also tortured in detention. They are beaten. They are subjected to electric shocks. And this has been going on for a long time, since the war started in 2013. But one would have expected that since the government has committed to releasing all political prisoners, they would have stopped arresting critics, but also released those that are already in detention. And that's what we are calling for, that those who are currently detained arbitrarily for no criminal charge should be released.
Save, as you said, that South Sudan has been involved in a civil war. These prisoners, are these war prisoners or ordinary South Sudanese?
These are mostly ordinary South Sudanese accused unfairly of communicating with the rebels, but also simply because they are from a certain ethnic community or hold certain political views, they tend to be taken in and pretty much disappeared into the corridors of the prisons and no one gets to see them again. So this is something that we were trying to address, to make sure that people detained for political reasons during the conflict are released.
Have you been able to talk to the South Sudan government about this report?
Yes, we did, and we always do. We always give right of reply to governments when we are about to launch reports talking about human rights situations in their jurisdictions. And you won't be surprised to hear that they denied it, and they always deny that they have political prisoners. But you remember that when the government and the opposition signed a position of hostilities agreement in 2017, they committed to releasing all political prisoners and political detainees. And they were actually supposed to give a list of prisoners of war to the International Committee of the Red Cross and to work towards releasing everyone arrested for political reasons during this period. That is in itself an admission that there are political prisoners in South Sudan. We've only seen about 30 released after an amnesty was issued by President Salva Kiir. But those are not the only people who have been arrested for political reasons. You're saying everyone who's been arrested and no internationally recognizable offense, whether criminal or civil, has been passed against them, they should be released immediately or charged in legitimate courts with properly constituted and internationally recognizable offenses.
How did you gain access to the prisoners? I mean, did you go to South Sudan?
Our South Sudan researchers traveled to South Sudan and met with families of people detained. And they told us what they are going through and what their loved ones are going through in detention. We also spoke to people who have been detained and later released to tell us about the conditions in detention. That's what we based our report on.
So you say here that suspected supporters of the armed opposition are increasingly targeted?
Many people have been arrested simply because they belong to the Nuer community of the opposition, the armed opposition leader, Riek Machar. So if someone speaks, many people have been picked up for some time, even especially during the heat of the violence, and they've been held for so long and accused of communicating with the rebels and accused of mobilizing support for them. But no evidence has been brought forward to substantiate their support or and whether that support is in any way criminal in nature.
You know that both the rebels and the South Sudan government and all the parties involved in the conflict signed a peace deal. And my understanding is that some political prisoners were released.
Yes, a peace agreement was signed in Khartoum, and an amnesty was issued by President Kiir for some political leaders on the opposition side, including the chief opposition leader himself, Riek Machar, and some people were released, about 30. But what we're saying here is that the political prisoners in South Sudan are not only 30, there are hundreds and hundreds of them.
That's Seif Magangu, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for East Africa. He was speaking to my colleague James Bati earlier today from Nairobi. The South Sudan government denies all of the charges contained in the report released this week by Amnesty International. Winnie Chirino has that story for VOA from Juba.
The report, entitled A Trail of Broken Promises, is based on testimonies of former detainees and groups of activists and other people who described experiences of abuse and torture to Amnesty International. Seif Magangu, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for East Africa, the Horn and the Great Lakes region, says although President Salva Kiir released 30 political detainees a year ago, arbitrary arrests and detentions continue in the country. Presidential spokesman Atenwe Katen calls the report fabricated.
All the allegations that came in the report were not new because they have been said before. Each time the government of South Sudan gets closer to returning the country to normalcy, such reports are just cut and faced and released.
The report says between February and July 2017, four men died in detention due to harsh conditions and a lack of medical care. It also reports that former detainees told Amnesty International they were made to drink water from the toilet and defecate and urinate in front of each other. The report quotes some former detainees who say they were rarely allowed out of their cells for sunlight or exercise and were never allowed to talk to each other. Amnesty International says it previously documented the deaths of more than 20 people in detention between February 2014 and December 2016 in South Sudan. Aten denies the charge.
The people that were actually reported to have been tortured to death, which are 21 in number, according to the report, are just a utopian number. There's no such number died as a result of torture.
Alilo's chair, President Salva Kiir, promised to release political detainees and subsequently released about 30 of them in August 2017. Then in December, during the signing of the cessation of hostilities agreement, and again in June during the signing of the ceasefire in Khartoum, the president vowed to release more political prisoners. But Amnesty International says security forces continue to make arbitrary arrests and detain real or perceived opponents such as Peter Biara Jack, a prominent South Sudanese academic who was arrested at Juba International Airport on July 28 and remains behind bars. Aten denies that Ajak is being illegally detained by security forces.
His case is still under investigation. As soon as the investigation is completed, a decision will be made either to charge him or to release him. This is how the law works. It is not peculiar to South Sudan.
Aten says that reports like Amnesty International's on South Sudan's arbitrary arrests and torture obstruct efforts by the country's leaders to restore peace.
Whenever such a statement is released, it is always detrimental to the implementation of peace agreement because it obstructs the peace implementers to get too defensive instead of continue to implement. So if Amnesty International is part of international community that would want to see South Sudan returning to normalcy, then they must be careful on what to talk about regards to South Sudan.
Magango is calling on the government to end arbitrary arrests and prosecute those responsible for human rights violations and deaths of political prisoners. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The South Sudan government says it is committed to addressing the root causes of displacement of people across the country due to conflict or natural disasters. Government and aid officials discussed how to include IDPs in decision-making processes on matters that affect them. Onan Walter Solomon has the story for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Humanitarian and Disaster Preparedness Ministry officials admitted the conflict has forced millions of South Sudanese out of their homes, including many who fled to neighboring countries. Speaking at an event marking the 20th anniversary of the signing of the Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement, Peter Gatwech, Undersecretary of South Sudan's Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Preparedness, says the government is drafting a law on internal displacement to help protect IDPs.
We've been working hand in hand with the humanitarian agencies and our colleagues within the region. The government recognizes the international treaties. That is why we've been, you know, there are so many works the government been doing. It's not only the IDP Act. There are other acts which are prioritized by the government.
The Draft IDP Act provides for the basic rights of IDPs and guarantees their right to land or compensation for land lost when they return to their villages. In addition, the IDP Act would require the government to provide social services, including reproductive health and education services to IDPs with the support of aid agencies. Gatwe says the draft will soon be handed over to the Justice Ministry for review. It will then be debated in Parliament. Gatwe says the measure could be passed by Parliament before December. Chaloka Biyoni authored the African Union Convention for the Protection and Assistance of Internally Displaced Persons in Africa during the Kampala Convention in 2012. He also authored the Great Lakes Pact and Protocol on IDPs in 2006. Nyanduka is urging South Sudan's leaders to involve IDPs in drafting the IDP Act.
If this legislation passes, South Sudan will have become the second country in Africa to have legislation on internally displaced persons. So it's a moment of significant development. It's also a moment to highlight the 20th anniversary of the Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement, which have come of age.
More than 4 million people have been displaced from their homes since South Sudan's civil war broke out in December 2015. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, conflict can impact on a country's maternal mortality. That's according to researchers. We'll bring details on that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who has been the kindest person to you in your life?
I think my mom. She's kind, or she tolerates everything that I do. Whether it's being good or bad, she does tolerate. So she's kind to me.
To be honest, there are so many. I cannot really remember one particular one, but there's nobody bad, actually, to me. There's nobody bad, because if somebody does something wrong or bad to me, I think that person is trying to educate me on a particular thing.
The kindest person to me in my life is my friend, whom we have studied together from my secondary school to university life. We're still together. He's always honest, and he's so kind to me.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Health professionals, researchers, and humanitarians are looking at the intersection of conflict and access to quality maternal health care around the world. SIN Deng Bio reports, the health experts found that the long-term consequences of conflict can impact maternal mortality, especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
One of the main targets of the United Nations Global Sustainable Development Goals is to reduce the global maternal mortality rate to less than 70 per 100,000 live births by 2030. Today, it's more than 200 per 100,000 live births. The World Health Organization says about 830 women die from pregnancy or childbirth-related complications around the world every day. Gudrun Ostby, a senior researcher at the Peace Research Institute Oslo, an independent peace and conflict studies research institution, says there has been progress on this front over the past year, but it has been slow on the African continent.
The current global maternal mortality rate is 216 per 100,000 live births, but for sub-Saharan Africa, the corresponding figure is 546.
During a recent panel discussion at the Washington-based Wilson Center, Ostby described the effect of conflict on maternal mortality in sub-Saharan Africa. Panelists said a variety of factors influence the high mortality rates. One of them, Dr. Iran Ben David, an infectious disease physician at Stanford Health Policy, says it takes countries years to recover from conflict.
It takes about 7 or 8 years for a conflict to return to baseline. Okay, so in the first year, it's about a 7.7% increase. In the second year, the year after, it's still about 7% higher than what you'd expect. And it starts going down, but it takes about 7 or 8 years before you see a return to what you would expect given the pre-conflict area.
Ostby points out the odds are against women in sub-Saharan Africa, where chances are that a woman there will die from complications related to pregnancy and childbirth during her life is 1 in 36 compared to 1 in 3,300 in high-income countries. Researchers explored why sub-Saharan Africa lags so far behind. Ostby says poor performance may be a long-term effect of conflict, but she says both conflict and health factors vary enormously within any given country. Local exposure to conflict is likely to have a negative impact on maternal health in a number of ways. For one, it could restrict free movement. Destruction of health infrastructures, looting of clinics, and violence against aid workers also impact access to maternal health, according to Ostby. She says conflict could also disrupt the economy.
An economic decline at the national level may decrease the financial capacity and channel resources away from healthcare. Also at the local level, conflict may impede agriculture and interrupt trade, leading to malnutrition and poverty.
Ostby says more nuanced data on the quality of service is needed to make policy decisions that could help keep mothers alive across sub-Saharan Africa. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has warned South African officials meeting in Zimbabwe to better prepare for expected drought or risk food insecurity. Columbus Mavunga has that report for VOA from Harare.
About an hour's drive south of Harare, 62-year-old maize farmer Leo Yuma is tending his land. With the rainy season expected in just weeks, Yuma, with no irrigation facilities for his maize field, he says he cannot sit still as drought is expected. He says all his children are unemployed, so they all depend on farming for survival. I do not irrigate. I depend on the rains, he says. I can't dictate to God what to do. I will depend on his rains for my maize, says Yuma. Back in Harare, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, is warning Southern African officials that investment, not prayer, is needed to prepare for drought. At a three-day meeting on ending hunger, the FAO warned Southern African nations must take measures to deal with the drought conditions or risk food security. Patrick Komawa is coordinator for the FAO in Southern Africa.
Drought is with us. I mean, this is one peculiar issue that countries have to take into consideration. You do not wait for the prediction before you put in measures to mitigate drought. This sub-region, only 7% of the land, arable land, is irrigated, which is about 34 million hectares. That is not acceptable. Investment in irrigation is very, very important. Investment in climate-resilient agriculture is very important.
Komawa says there is about 40% chance the region will be hit again this year by the El Nino weather pattern with the high temperatures and low rainfall. The last El Nino-induced drought from 2014 to 2016 led to 40 million people requiring food assistance across southern Africa. Madagascar and Zimbabwe were among some of the worst hit countries. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
From Harare, we move to DRC, where officials worry that an Ebola outbreak in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo could be spreading despite early detection and a concerted effort to contain it. The Congolese Health Ministry said yesterday the five-week-old outbreak has killed 85 people, with another 124 cases of the disease confirmed. There are reports of two probable cases in Butembo, roughly 60 kilometers from the outbreak's epicenter in Bandaka and Beni. Officials say they don't know the cause of the transmission despite concerted efforts to track everyone who came into contact with people who have contracted the deadly disease. The DRC Health Ministry says health workers have run into resistance to help from some families who have been hiding sick people and refusing to be vaccinated. UNICEF says education efforts in four languages on how to reduce the risk of catching Ebola have reached 2.5 million of the area's 11 million people. Health workers are using a vaccine that proved effective in preventing transmission of the virus in an outbreak in another part of the country earlier this year. The first treatment drugs are being used for those already infected. At least two patients have recovered. The effort is also complicated because the area of the outbreak is a conflict zone with about 100 armed groups. An international money transfer company has launched an online service for East Africans to send and receive money more easily. Analysts say World Remit will lower the cost of transferring money and boost African trade and economies. For VOA, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Africa has become a thriving market for money transfer companies as its telecommunication facilities improve and its economies grow. World Remit, a British-based money transfer company, recently launched a new digital service in four East African countries. The company facilitates the transfer of at least $1.6 billion to Africa each year. The co-founder and the head of World Remit, Ismail Ahmed, tells VOA how money transfers in Africa have changed over the years.
When we launched our services, 99% of remittances were cash on both the send side and the receive side. But today, that is changing fast. And in the next few years, we think as much as 50-60% of international remittances will move from traditional physical cash, traditional remittances, to digital. And that's why our services have grown very fast in the last few years.
Ahmed says that as transactions become digital, the cost of each transfer comes down and tracking money becomes easier.
It is easier for individuals and business to move money within the countries, but also across countries. It is easier to fight financial crime, because when transactions become digital, there is an audit trail compared to cash when there is no audit trail.
Gerishoni Kiara is an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says digital money transfers will boost trade within Africa, but notes that some countries still lack the necessary connections.
Obviously, the main challenge is the level of infrastructure, because a country without good infrastructure in terms of electricity and telecommunication infrastructure will make it a bit difficult.
The World Bank says $37.8 billion was sent to Africa through remittances in 2017. This year, the amount is expected to be $39 billion. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for East Africa, Seth Magongo, says people in South Sudan continue to be arrested and detained arbitrarily for long periods of time. Some are even tortured while in detention, according to Magongo. They've also been shocked and beaten. He says it's been going on for a long time now, since the civil war started, and despite President Salva Kiir's promise to release all detainees, many are still being held. Amnesty released its report yesterday, documenting how security forces continue to arrest real and perceived opponents of the government without ever being charged with a crime. The South Sudan government denies the charges in the new amnesty report, with presidential spokesman Atene Wekatene calling it a fabrication. Atene claims each time the country gets closer to returning to normalcy, these kinds of reports are released. Amnesty says four men died while in detention due to harsh conditions between February and July of last year. Atene denies it. He also denied that South Sudanese PhD student Peter Biar Ajok is being detained illegally. And finally, the government says it's committed to ending the internal displacement of millions of people in South Sudan. Peter Gatwich, undersecretary of the country's Ministry of Humanitarian and Disaster Preparedness, said today that the government is drafting a new law to help protect IDPs. He says officials are working with humanitarian agencies to write the new law that will spell out the rights of IDPs and guarantee their rights to land or compensation for land that they lost when they were forced from their villages during the five-year conflict. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Harami by CJ Oman. What's up? We have been listening to CJ Oman with the song Harami. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being with us. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mama Katulu Sangana Maya.
Hagegiseregu Sister Jurumino Oshanta Hagegiseregu Kuluzol Giseregu Uingu Sabapto Kuluzol Gishakilu